welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we visit with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. He resides within the Department of Plant Pathology at UW and also Extension. Talk with him today about the diseases that have shown up a lot this year. And, of course, we'll take your questions as well, and you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Brian Huddleston, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for having me on the show again. Pleasure to be here.
Lots of excitement for your top 10 plant disease list, Brian. But before we start, tell us the factors that have had the biggest influence on what makes that list.
I think amount of water actually is the biggest one if we look at all of the things that are on the list. And it really isn't truly a top 10 disease list as top 10 problem list, because there are several things on there that aren't true diseases. But if you look through all of those things on there, many of them are influenced by the amount of rain and moisture we've had over the past summer. So definitely that's been a contributing factor.
Well, let's start at the bottom of our list, number 10 on the list, and work our way up. And number 10, I believe, is Rhizosphaera needlecast?
That's correct. And that's always on my top 10 list every year. Oftentimes, it's number one. I see a lot of spruces that come into my clinic where people are concerned about the fact that, particularly on lower branches, the interior needles are dropping off. And that's characteristic of this fungal disease. It infects actually the new needles as they're produced in the spring. That kind of hangs out there and doesn't do a lot of damage until those needles age a little bit and are farther back in the canopy. And then it'll cause a lot of thinning of the lower canopy, kind of working from the trunk out and then from the bottom of the tree up. And it really limits the utility of Colorado blue spruce in our landscape, which was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, an incredibly popular tree and still is. It's not one I recommend now, just because of this disease, but there are a lot of them in the environment.
Do we need to treat it? Is it preventable?
Yeah, the prevention is basically don't plant a Colorado blue spruce or other susceptible spruce trees. That includes white spruce. And one type of white spruce is Black Hill spruce, which is a very popular type of white spruce. And usually if people want to grow spruce trees, if you have enough space, I recommend Norway spruce, because that particular type of spruce has a very open canopy, so you get a lot of good airflow that tends to dry things out in the canopy and kind of helps prevent this disease from being a problem. I usually tell folks, try something else. If you want something that kind of looks like a Colorado blue spruce with that sort of coloring, and you have really good soil drainage, something like a white fir, I think, is a really nice alternative to Colorado blue spruce. You just have to have good drainage, and you have to be willing to water that tree if it gets really dry. It's a little picky in terms of water. In terms of treatment of existing trees, there are fungicide treatments, but I usually don't recommend those. With larger trees, it's virtually impossible to get good coverage to control the disease. And so my recommendation is, just as those lower branches thin, just prune those branches off so you're left with a canopy that's a little fuller. You get what we call a lollipop tree, but yeah, it's better than not having a tree at all.
I'm thinking, aren't blue spruce a popular Christmas tree?
Yes, and I think that's one of the reasons why people like to grow them in their yard. They want a Christmas tree all year round. And unfortunately, I tend not to see any Colorado blue spruce that really look like any sort of Christmas tree that you would care to have in your home. So,
all right. Well, let's move on to number 9, Diplodia shoot blight and canker. What is it, and why did it show up a lot this year?
Yeah, another oldie and goodie. It's another one that tends to show up on my list quite frequently. This is another fungal disease. It tends to be a problem primarily on Austrian pine, which is another tree that's been planted a lot in urban settings because it's very salt tolerant, which is something that we do need in our urban settings where we use salt, particularly in Wisconsin in the wintertime, to deal with snow and ice. unfortunately, it tends to be that tree and other related pines. So we see it also in yugo and red pine, tend to be prone to infection. And this particular fungus requires at least a little bit of moisture, a little bit of rain to coat the needles. That provides the environment that allows the fungal spores to germinate and the fungus to get into the tree. But then if you put the tree under a lot of water stress, the pathogen seems to get more aggressive. So if you take the same tree, have them both infected, one gets a lot of water, the other one is water stress, the water stress tree tends to show more severe symptoms. And we see a lot of this just because there are a lot of Austrian pines. I've also seen instances where this has been problematic after storm damage. So there was a tornado that came through northwestern Wisconsin several years ago, and the path went for many, many miles, and it went through some stands of red pine. And shortly thereafter, they had really severe diplodia. And this is another one where if you're going to plant a pine, don't plant an Austrian pine. That's probably the best way to deal with it. If you have an Austrian pine that's showing branch tip dieback, that's what you normally see with this disease, pruning out those branches carefully down about 4 to 6 inches below where you see obvious brown needles at the tips, and then decontaminate your tools between cuts, then you can kind of get it under control that way. There are some fungicide treatments you could do for this one that seem to work relatively well, but you'd have to have a professional come in and make those applications for you.
Brian Huddleston, our guest today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. I saw number 8 on your list, and I thought, well, no surprise that powdery mildew's there. Why was it such a problem?
Yeah, I actually didn't see a lot of powdery mildew samples come into my lab. I usually don't, because everybody kind of knows what powdery mildews look like. So it's not a great moneymaker for my clinic in terms of diseases. I run my clinic like a small business, so I do charge for my service. So I like getting powdery mildews in because they're super easy to diagnose and I can make, you know, $25 very easily. But the reason why we would see a lot of powdery mildews, again, was our environmental conditions. We had a relatively dry early part of the summer. And I talked a little bit about with the diplodia where you needed some rain to get the needles wet for the fungus to infect. And that's true of most fungi that infect leaves and needles. They require what's called a leaf wetness period. So when there's a layer of water on the leaf surface or needle surface, powdery mildews are kind of the exception to that. They really don't like wet leaves. What they like is really dry conditions where the leaves are dry, but where it's really muggy. And that's a very typical weather pattern for Wisconsin. We had, and particularly this year where we had a dry early part of the summer, but then you get into July, early July, super muggy. That's what we typically expect in Wisconsin in the summer. And the powdery mildews just go wild. And there are lots of different powdery mildew fungi. They tend to be relatively specific in terms of which plant they infect. And if you ever want to see these, if you haven't seen powdery mildews before, check out lilacs. They are the poster child for powdery mildew. And powdery mildew, to see what sort of damage they cause, which is usually relatively little. Lilacs get lots of powdery mildew, but it really doesn't severely affect them. Where it is more of a problem are on some older varieties of things like phlox, monardas. If you grow pumpkins or other vine crops, they can cause enough damage to get some leaf browning. And then with woody ornamentals, again, oftentimes a cosmetic problem, but if you happen to be growing the red leaf varieties of ninebark, particularly Diablo, I've seen really severe powdery mildew on those ninebarks to the point where you get branch tip dieback. But that's very unusual for powdery mildews. And most of the time I tell people with powdery mildews, ignore them. Okay. You have better things to worry about than powdery mildew.
Goldie in Oregon emailed, she has a very large hydrangea bush in her front yard. This year it had many leaves, but no flowers at all. She noticed a bit of mold on the branches at the bottom of the plant. What was going on? Maybe she says, should she cover the hydrangea plant for winter? And is there some vitamin or mineral she could give it in the spring?
Again, with flowering, oftentimes it's if it just doesn't flower at all, it's oftentimes not necessarily a disease issue, but it could be something environmental. It could be that there was a cold snap at some point that killed off the flower buds. It could be if it was pruned at the wrong time, and hydrangeas, different types of hydrangeas need to be pruned at different times of the year. And if the plants were pruned improperly, they may have pruned out the flower buds. This would actually be a great question for, I believe Lisa Johnson is on next week as your
Yes.
guest. And she would be, I would suggest this caller call in and talk to Lisa about proper pruning of hydrangeas. In terms of the mold that they're seeing at the base of the plant, a couple things that it could be lichens. These are little, really weird symbiotic organisms. They're kind of part alga, part fungus, and then part yeast, which is actually another type of fungus that lives symbiotically together, and they just like to grow on things. So you'll see these on tree trunks, on the branches of shrubs, and they really don't cause damage. They're just using that as a surface to grow on. If you're seeing mold that's kind of short-lived, it could be a slime mold. These are quite
Yeah.
common after you've spread new mulch. These are really cool organisms, part of their life. They're kind of like an amoeba and they crawl around part of their life. They're like a fungus and produce spores. And they will form on newly spread mulch. The common one is what we call affectionately dog vomit slime mold or scrambled egg slime mold that looks like your neighbor's
Yeah.
dog upchucked on your mulch. And those can actually move and grow up the base of the plants. Again, totally cosmetic. They are not disease-causing organisms. And they just look very disturbing to a lot of people, and but they don't cause damage.
Well, at number 7 on your list is fire blight, and you say many people think they have it, but they actually don't.
Right, and that's why it actually showed up on my list, is not because I saw a ton of fire blight this year, but I had a lot of people ask me to test for it. And the problem is people have heard about fire blight typically, so they know that it can affect trees like apples and crab apples and pears. And it's a bacterial disease that typically enters through the flowers. Actually, the culprit, unfortunately, is pollinators like honeybees. They actually acquire the bacterium and then they will drop it off in the flowers as they pollinate. Infection occurs and then that leads to the death of the tips of the branches. And so when anybody sees any sort of branch dieback on an apple, crab apple, or pear, all of a sudden, it has to be fire blight. And so we get samples that come in. People think it's fire blight. I have a little, it's a dipstick test. It's kind of like the plant disease equivalent to a home pregnancy test. Uses the same technology and it detects the organism, the bacterium that causes this disease. And I will use that right away to test tissue. And most of the time it's negative. We do get some positives, but when I get the negatives, then I start looking for other causes. And there is a little fungus called Spirorhopsis that is a common canker organism. It'll girdle branches. And I oftentimes see that on apples and crab apples and pears. That fungus can also infect fruits and cause a fruit rot. It also causes something called frog eye leaf spot on the leaves. That's kind of a dead end for the fungus. It doesn't produce spores very well on the leaf tissue. But we do see a lot of dieback from that particular organism. And sometimes it can be drought stress. It could be, quite frankly, if you didn't have a lot of snow and temperatures got really cold, the soil temperatures can get really, really cold and that can damage roots and that can translate into branch dieback as well. So if you see branch dieback on apples, crab apples, or pears, yeah, it could be fire blight, but keep in mind there are lots of other things that can cause those symptoms.
Brian Huddleston, our guest, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, as we talk with him on this edition of Garden Talk. Questions, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Huddleston, Dr. Death, as he is sometimes called, talking plant disease with him. And just a reminder, we're partnering with UW-Madison's Extension Horticulture Program to learn more about your experience listening to Garden Talk. Love to find out what you learned during the show and how you might put it to good use. And we'd also like your ideas for future Garden Talk topics. And all you have to do is go to WPR.org/Larry and then click on today's show note for a link. It only take you a minute or two. WPR.org/Larry and go to today's show and click on the link. Or you can type in go.wisc.edu/radio to any browser. It'll just take you a couple minutes, and I hope you'll join in on that. Well, Greg in Sheboygan has a question. Let's go there.
Hello. I'm calling because I have a cousin, and she was planting pine trees somewhere around Rhinelander with her class, and she got some kind of a fungus from the soil, and it got in her lungs, and she almost died from it. She was very sick for about almost a year, and I was wondering if you are familiar with anything that like that.
Yeah, it could be something like blastomycosis, which is the name of the disease that's caused by a fungus that's commonly found in, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on this particular topic. This is really more of a medical topic than one with plant diseases, but I do get questions occasionally about this, oftentimes found in areas where there's a fair amount of soil moisture, and a lot of times farther up north. It can cause problems in humans. Dogs oftentimes come down with this particular disease as well. And I believe this was the disease where I had talked to a client and her dog had gone blind from this particular problem. So it can be serious. And it's usually with fungal diseases of humans, they're very difficult or at least a challenge to treat because fungi genetically are somewhat closely related to us as humans, more so than bacteria. And so a lot of the antibiotics that you use for trying to treat fungal diseases of humans tend to be pretty toxic to us. So it can be very tough to get rid of those. So yeah, sorry to hear about that. That's a horrible, horrible disease to have.
Yeah, I had what the doctors called a mild case, and believe me, it didn't feel mild to me.
Yeah.
I was sick for a few days, but it sounds like Greg's relative had a much harder time of it.
Yeah.
Greg, thank you for calling. Lee in Green Bay will go to you. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. My question is, I've got about 4 Accolade elms that are at least 25 years old. I noticed that sometime in mid-August, some of the top crown area, the leaves were kind of dying back, turning yellowish. I would like to know if a sample was sent down to him at this time of the year when the tree is dormant. Could you still tell if, you know, it might have Dutch elm disease starting?
Yeah, as long as you know which of those branches were the branches that were yellowing and dying back, if you can easily identify those, I could potentially test for you. That fungus lives inside the water conducting tissue inside the branches, so it will survive the winter there. And if you get me a good sample, usually what I like to see is 3 branches that are about an inch in diameter, if you can get those for me, and that are about 6 to 8 inches long of those branches that were yellowing and dying back. And what we do to identify the disease is we just try to grow the fungus out of the tissue. We actually, it's really great because I get to use fire when I do this. You dip the branches in some alcohol and then you burn it off to decontaminate the surface of the branch. It's always, you'll always have a fire extinguisher close when you do that. I've lit some really spectacular alcohol fires before. But then you peel off the bark and you look at the tissue right underneath the bark. And if the Dutch elm disease fungus is there, you'll see a discoloration in that tissue, oftentimes streaking, or if it's if the case is developed enough, oftentimes the entire vascular kind of circle right underneath the bark is totally brown. And then we take little pieces of that and put it on a growth medium, and it grows out in about 5 days, and it produces what I call the lollipops of death. It's a little reproductive structure produced by the fungus that looks like a lollipop with a black stalk with a white kind of lollipop at the top, and that's a mass of spores. And what's really interesting is that bark beetles, if they get into a tree with Dutch elm disease, they'll dig tunnels and lay their eggs, and the fungus is actually, it will naturally produce these little lollipops into those little chasms that they've dug into the trails. And so when the larvae and the adult insects move around, they actually pick up the spores on their body. And then when they leave the tree, they can visit another tree and drop it off. But yeah, definitely send a sample to us. Let me give you my clinic website where you can find information with my address and where to submit. And also you can check out the fees. That's P as in Paul, D as in David, D as in David again, C as in Charles, dot W-I-S-C dot E-D-U. And my email is also on that website. So if you have any questions, feel free to drop me an email.
So it's P-D-D-C dot W-I-S-C dot E-D-U?
That's correct.
Okay. There you go. Thanks very much, Lee, for calling. Appreciate it. You know, he mentioned elm, and I was immediately thought of oaks, because oak wilt is number six on your list.
Dutch elm disease and oak wilt are very similar diseases. And in fact, the two pathogens at one time were actually classified in the same fungal genus. So they're very, very similar. The oak wilt fungus also colonizes the water conducting tissue, causes blockages, which lead to branch dieback, the same as Dutch elm disease. And yeah, I do a lot of testing for oak wilt, but it's kind of like the situation for fire blight. Everybody sees their oaks dying back and they think it's oak wilt. And I'm happy to test for you because we really do want to know if you happen to have oak wilt. But oftentimes the samples are negative for oak wilt. We use a couple of different techniques, a culturing technique where we try to grow the fungus out. And then we have a really cool DNA-based technique where we can actually assay for the genetic material of the organism. And that's a little bit more sensitive test that we can use. And most of the time, the samples come back negative. I think this year, only about 20% of the samples that were submitted were positive. And the thing of it is, there are a couple of lookalike problems that you may be dealing with. The big one is actually an insect issue called two-line chestnut borer. And that insect will tunnel in. Its larvae will basically create channels underneath the bark and disrupt the water conducting tissue. And that's what leads to the dieback. And again, this is kind of weather related, because two-line chestnut borer tends to be an insect that's attracted to trees that are under stress. And so when we have drought stressed trees, particularly oaks, they tend to be very prone to being visited by this insect, and the insect causes a lot of damage, and it can kill the trees eventually. And then in terms of other diseases, particularly if you're farther north in the state, there's a disease called armillaria root disease. And this is fungal, and it's a fungus that actually produces mushrooms. So if you've ever heard of honey mushrooms, that's actually the mushroom that's produced by this organism. And it's a creepy kind of fungus in a way, because it colonizes through the roots and kind of grows underneath the bark. And if the bark oftentimes loosens, and then you can see this kind of flat, whitish fungal growth right along the wood under the bark. But as it ages, it starts to produce these root-like structures. They're called rhizomores, and those grow out into the soil. And they're basically, I don't want to make it sound like it knows what it's doing, but it's like it's searching for other root systems. So if those rhizomores come into contact with other roots, that allows an opportunity for the fungus to infect. And there's a huge colony of this organism in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. In fact, if you go up there, you'll see there's a town up there, and I can't remember the name, that actually has a mushroom fest, which is actually a celebration of this particular fungus because of this huge colony that's up there. And that usually causes a slower decline of oak trees than what you see with oak wilt. Oftentimes oak wilt will kill trees quickly. Armillaria is a little bit slower, but armillaria also causes branch dieback. So you've got to be careful. And actually, if you have armillaria and you call it oak wilt and do what I normally recommend for management, which is to actually sever root grafts, because the oak wilt fungus can move through the roots, you can actually make armillaria worse, because that opens up wounds that armillaria likes to use as an entry point into other trees. So, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
That's a reason to get a proper diagnosis.
It is indeed. Let's take one more, and then we'll go to the phones. Chlorosis was number five.
Yeah, and that one is, again, is another one that tends to show up on my list every year. It's a little maybe higher this year. And again, probably because of dry weather. Chlorosis is actually a nutrient deficiency. It's not a true disease. It's usually a lack of either iron or manganese in a plant. And where I commonly see this is if you grow pin oaks. But other susceptible trees are birch, red maple. If you try to grow rhododendrons or azaleas, they're very prone. Blueberries have problems with this. White pine can be quite sensitive. And it's not necessarily that there's a lack of iron or manganese in our soils. The big problem in Wisconsin is that our underlying bedrock in many areas is limestone, and that tends to increase the soil pH. And at higher soil pHs, iron and manganese can't be taken up very easily by plants. They kind of get locked in the soil. And so the other thing that tends to make this worse is if we don't have a lot of water, because water will help mobilize these nutrients to get them into the root system. And if we have a lot of drought, then that's just another reason that the plants can't take up iron or manganese. And it's very important with trees and shrubs to know whether in that particular plant, if you have chlorosis, whether it's an iron deficiency or a manganese deficiency, because if it's really a manganese deficiency and you think it's iron and add iron, that actually makes the problem worse because the iron will compete with manganese uptake. And you'll actually end up with a plant with less manganese. And very distinctive symptoms with chlorosis, yellowish leaves, so lighter colored leaf blades with very distinctive dark green veins. And it can get so severe that that tissue in between the veins will actually die and turn brown.
Wow.
So,
There you go. Chuck in West Salem, we go to you. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, I would seek the opinion of a plant pathologist regarding the current status of resistance to chestnut blight. There certainly have been efforts made to cross our native chestnuts with Chinese chestnuts and attempt to transfer the resistance genes to the blight. And I wanted your opinion as to how successful these crosses have been and whether or not we are at a point where I should invest some time and money into purchasing some chestnut seedlings.
Yeah, I'm not a real expert on this particular disease. I am aware that there's breeding that's been going on. There have been people that have looked for our native chestnuts that are resistant to the disease. I'm aware of the crosses that you're talking about. I don't know exactly how successful those have been. What I'll say in general, and this kind of gets back to the person who questioned about the Accolade elms. That's technically an elm that is resistant to Dutch elm disease. Anytime you have a resistant tree to a particular disease, that doesn't mean that it's immune. So what that means that is it's probably still susceptible to infection by the pathogen. It's just that the disease progresses typically more slowly in the resistant variety. And so that tends to give you some options in terms of using other management techniques to try to keep the disease under control. What I would suggest if you want to try to grow these trees would be to just try a few of them in your area to see how they perform. But keep in mind that the larger the population of chestnuts that you grow, the more likely you're eventually going to see the disease. Way back when I was in graduate school, I took a course where we kind of traveled around the state, and they actually took us to a location where there was a huge mature American chestnut that was still surviving. And probably the reason it had survived for so long was it was the only chestnut around in the area. So it was very, very isolated. And so there wasn't a lot of chance for the pathogen to get to it. So I would be cautious. I would be optimistically cautious, though. I certainly would experiment with some of those resistant varieties if you can find them and see what happens. I'm always up to doing kind of experiments in your own yard. I think that's a great way to learn a lot of things.
Good points. And Chuck, thanks. I was thinking about elms. There's a few elms that I've seen, the old, old elms, and they're always by themselves, out in
Yes.
the, you know, alone and away from others.
Yeah. Or if you're in a more urban setting, they're really small trees. Years ago, Madison used to have a requirement. There was actually a city ordinance that the elms and oaks in the city had to be inspected by the city foresters for Dutch elm disease and oak wilt. And anytime they had suspicious trees, they would bring a sample to my lab for confirmation. And they, on their submission forms, they actually had the diameter of the trunks. And I noticed over the years that typically once the trees got to be about 6 to 8 inches in diameter, that's when I started to see samples coming from those trees. And I think it's in that situation, it's a function of the fact that the fungus is brought in by bark beetles, and they probably prefer slightly larger trees rather than the small saplings.
Michael in Appleton has something relating to what we've just been talking about. Michael, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for taking my call. I heard the previous caller, and I wanted to call in. My grandfather was a professor at UW-Madison, professor of agriculture, for a long time until he retired. And they still live in Madison, but they have 500 acres or so near Spring Green. And years ago, through connections at UW, he got some seeds for some of the early crosses between the American and Chinese chestnuts, and planted a whole grove of those out at what we call the cabin. I remember he was telling me all about him, and it was sort of in the early days of a lot of genetic science, so it was pretty cutting edge at the time. But the trees themselves, the chestnuts, they're growing, they're still doing pretty well. They're not shooting up, but they're there and they're growing. So I just wanted to kind of share that story related to the previous call.
Would you mind telling us what your grandfather's name?
Yes. Bruce Marion.
Oh, Bruce Marion. Okay. A name I know quite well, and I don't know, Brian, if you...
No, unfortunately, it's probably...
I'm older than you are.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great story. Thank you, Michael. Yeah. It's nice to know Bruce's trees are doing that well, and for others, why not give it a try? Why not experiment?
Yep.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it very much. On to number four, which was boxwood issues, and you kind of grouped them all together to make the list, the boxwood.
I just see a lot of boxwoods that don't perform particularly well, and there can be a variety of issues. Sometimes it's hardiness issues. There are a lot of boxwood varieties, but there are only a very limited number that will survive well in Wisconsin, survive our winters. So it's very important to make sure you research properly if you're going to buy a boxwood shrub, to make sure it's hardy in our hardiness zones here in Wisconsin, which tend to be zones 5, 4, and 3 as we get farther north. You're going to be very hard pressed to find boxwoods that will be really hardy to zone 3. That's pretty unusual. The other thing that we tend to see are issues with what we call winter burn, which is a dehydration that occurs in the shrubs over the winter time. So if the shrubs aren't getting enough water into the fall, they don't have that water stored internally, and they do use some water as they go for the winter. They are evergreen, and so they will dehydrate, and that will cause the leaves to turn brown. And we can see this occur over the winter, or sometimes it's most severe and becomes very dramatic just as the plants are coming out of dormancy. And then from a disease standpoint, what we're really concerned about is a relatively new disease in the state called boxwood blight. And if you want to see how devastating this disease can be, I suggest doing an internet search. Just type in boxwood blight and then your favorite state along the eastern seaboard. So North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, any of those states. And there are photos of landscapes that were primarily landscaped with boxwood, where every shrub is dead from this particular disease.
Wow.
So there are a limited number of varieties. There was some work that was done testing varieties for resistance at North Carolina State University. And there are some varieties that are resistant. So again, if you want to grow boxwood, I would suggest getting a boxwood blight resistant variety if you need some specific names. Again, check my website, shoot me an email, and I can send you the list that we have. It's relatively small, probably only about a half a dozen or so varieties. I have seen this disease only once in Wisconsin. It came in on nursery stock in the southeast in Kenosha County initially. And then I had one landscape sample that actually came to my clinic a couple of years ago. And the classic symptoms for this disease, it starts out as kind of brown spots in the leaves, but there are so many infections that the leaves eventually collapse and kind of turn brown. And because this is a new disease, because it potentially has a huge impact on boxwood production and use in the state, if you think you have boxwood blight, and quite frankly, even if you don't, but you've got something wrong with your boxwood, you want to know what it is, send in a sample to my clinic, invoke the words boxwood blight, and we'll do a free diagnosis for you. Mm-hmm. And then if we find a positive case of boxwood blight, we do have to report that to the State Department of Agriculture. And in this case, in the Madison area, some folks from Department of Ag actually came out and talked with them about where they'd gotten their plants and then provided them with information on how to get rid of those plants and manage the disease. So they're not there to punish you or anything. They're just there to help and try to figure out why the problem happens. So lots of boxwood issues. Yeah.
Gary in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I have a Japanese lilac that's probably about 10 years old, at least. Mm-hmm. And I started noticing a couple of years ago that there were branches kind of in, you know, in the middle of it that all of a sudden were, looked like they were dead. And
okay.
The tree just did not look well. And then again, now this past summer and spring, it seems to have gotten even a little worse. And the, you know, mm-hmm. the blooms, they're not really coming out well. And
okay.
About 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I had a tree expert who actually injected something. It was either in the ground or possibly in the tree that was going to make it so that it didn't get too large in my yard. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but that's the case. Do you know anything that could be?
Yeah, there are some growth regulators that arborists will use that will kind of increase the roots on the trees but prevent them from producing a lot of above-ground growth. Those are used in situations where you have trees that can get really big in areas where there really isn't enough space for them. I don't think that's probably what has caused the problem with your tree, given that you're talking about branch dieback on a, you said it was a Japanese lilac in particular. My suspicion is a disease called verticillium wilt. This is a kind of another disease very similar to oak wilt and Dutch elm disease. It colonizes the water conducting tissue in the plant. It's a fungus that does this. It's a little different, because the oak wilt and the Dutch elm disease fungus is oftentimes initially introduced by insects, but verticillium is actually a soil-borne fungus. So it actually infects through the roots, colonizes the water conducting tissue and blocks it off and causes branch dieback. And Japanese tree lilac is quite susceptible to this disease, and it would cause just really poor growth. And quite frankly, I would expect the tree to decline relatively rapidly and eventually die. If you're interested in, you know, testing for this, we can certainly do that for you. The reason it's nice to know if you have verticillium is because if you do, that really limits what you can plant as a replacement tree, because that fungus has a very wide host range. So that would be my first suspicion based on what you've described. But that kind of actually leads us into number three on my list.
Yeah, Septoria.
Because there's another disease that we've been seeing a lot of. But again, based on your description, I don't necessarily think this is the primary problem in your lilac. But there has been a leaf disease called Septoria leaf spot that last year, 2020 and 2021, both has been relatively severe. It was particularly bad in 2020, I think, because we'd had a couple of years where it was really wet. So 2018 and 19 and early 2020 was pretty wet. And I think that allowed enough time for this fungus to build up in the environment. So then it really, really caused a lot of problems. And the way it infects is through the leaves. it just affects the leaves. It doesn't affect the branches, but it can cause the leaves to totally turn brown and fall off. And one thing to check in your tree, just to make sure that it isn't the septoria, is to check those branches where you're seeing the dieback and see whether you see any indication right now at this time of the year of buds for next year. So there should be nice green buds on your lilacs just waiting to come out next year. If you don't see those on those branches that have kind of stopped producing leaves in it, you're not dealing with the septoria. It's more likely, again, this verticillium disease. But for those of you who have lilacs where the leaves totally turned brown and fell off, and you're worried that your shrubs or trees are dead, go out there and check the branches. Look for buds for next year. Most likely you're going to find them. And if you do find those buds, probably what you were dealing with is the septoria disease. Now, people have probably heard of septoria before because you've probably heard about it in the context of tomatoes. If you ever had tomato plants that defoliate from the bottom up, one of the common pathogens that causes that is a species of septoria. But it's a different septoria that's going to your lilacs versus your tomatoes. Management, though, is pretty much very similar. Good fall cleanup of all of that leaf debris. Get rid of that. Either you have that option, bury it so it's totally covered with soil, or if you're a good hot composter, you can compost it. And then with lilacs, particularly shrub lilacs, what I'm really telling folks is to get into a routine of thinning those shrubs. So normally what you do is you kind of look at all of the canes in that shrub, pick a third of them, the largest diameter ones, and you prune those out. That opens up the canopy, increases airflow. That promotes drying of the leaves when they get wet and very rapid drying. And those drier conditions are less conducive for the septoria leaf spot. In fact, I didn't get a lot of cases of septoria leaf spot early in the season because it was so dry. It was once we started to get rains here in the Madison area in July, late July and into August, that all of a sudden people started to call me about this disease. And that was a function of having wetter leaves. But you should be able to get that under control just using cultural methods. If you've had a chronic problem with this leaf browning, there are fungicide treatments. And again, if you want details on that, just contact me.
Brian Huddleston, our guest, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. We're going through his top 10 list of plant diseases for 2021 and certainly answering your questions as well. I hope you join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Want to go through those last two. We've got Dean in Harper's Ferry, Iowa. We'll get to you, Dean. But number two on your list was actually problems due to poor planting.
Yeah, again, a non-disease issue. But because of COVID, I've been doing a lot more digital diagnostics. So people have been sending me a lot more photographs, which has given me kind of a different perspective of what's going on in the environment. I can see whole trees and what they look like. I can't tell you how many times people contact me. Their trees are declining. They've got branch dieback, poor leaf set, early fall color. And it's really due to the fact that years ago when they were planted, they were not planted properly. So the big issues are overly deep planting. So if you're planting a tree or shrub, you want the root flare. That's the area where the trunk widens to form the root system. Just above the soil line. In a lot of the trees I see, that's been buried. That tends to put a lot of stress on the trees. And so they end up developing a variety of problems. And then the other things that I see are when people buy bald and burlap trees and shrubs, they don't take the burlap off. They don't take the wire basket off. The worst thing you can do is leave the wires around the main trunk on. That will eventually girdle the tree. And oftentimes those bald and burlap materials, when you buy them, the root flare is already buried in the root ball. So you need to remove that topsoil and then get them planted at the proper depth. And then you really need to make sure you're watering adequately when you transplant. And for most trees and shrubs, about 2 inches of water per week for about 3 years after transplanting. That starts for evergreens when the ground thaws, for deciduous trees when they start to leaf out. And then throughout the summer, either from natural rain or supplemental watering with a soaker or drip hose, and then water into the fall for deciduous trees until they start to turn their normal fall color, with evergreens all the way up to the point where we get a significant snowfall or the ground freezes.
And finally, we'll get a drum roll from Tyler here. Tyler, have you got a drum roll for us? The number one disease goes to...
A non-disease again. Drought stress. And you may have guessed this based on all the other comments that I made, but because we had a very dry summer last year, at least the latter half of the summer going into the fall, and then we had a very dry early spring, I saw a lot of issues where plants were turning brown, particularly evergreens, boxwoods, arborvitaes, those sorts of plants, and also deciduous trees. There was a lot of browning as well, and it was simply because they just weren't getting enough water. And so I mentioned new transplants getting about 2 inches of water per week. With established trees and shrubs, they really like about an inch of water per week, again, over the same time frame that I described before, from roughly leafing out through the time when they either turn their normal fall color, or for evergreens, later into the fall until the ground freezes or there's a significant snowfall. So get out there if you've got really precious plants. They need to be watered when we have drought. Now, do I do that? No, I'm a Darwinian gardener. I put things in, give them benign neglect, and if they survive, they were supposed to be in my yard.
Dean in Harpers Ferry, Iowa, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Been very informative this morning. You were talking earlier about fire blight and stuff on fruit trees. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I have, and I seem to have this proverbial problem with the Honeycrisp apple tree. Some of the other varieties I grow don't exhibit this, but I get this sooty black coloring on the trunk of the tree, on some of the branches, and it's very difficult. I'm not sure what that is, but it seems to really take hold onto the Honeycrisp variety, and I think I've planted my last Honeycrisp because the other ones seem to be doing better. So I don't know how to manage that. What it is, it's probably not the fire blight, but I'd really like to figure out what it is because it's a very nice apple.
Yeah, I think what you're probably dealing with, the dark color is sooty mold. It's actually a fungal growth, but that's actually not what's causing problems with the trees. We tend to get an increase in sooty molds when you have a lot of either scale or aphid activity in a tree, and they feed on the plants and then they secrete, it's actually their feces, it's called honeydew. That falls in the branches, it falls in the trunks, it can fall in the leaves. And that's a very nutritious material that these environmental fungi, the sooty mold fungi, can grow on. And that's why you see all this kind of blackish, fuzzy sort of growth. So I would look to see whether you've got a lot of scale or aphid activity in those trees. It's probably the underlying problem. I thought when you said that you were going to talk about the fact on your Honeycrisp that you had really blotchy leaf color, because that's the most common thing that I tend to see on Honeycrisp. There's a disorder called Honeycrisp leaf chlorosis, which is a physiological disorder. It's part of the genetics of that particular tree. And in many instances, the leaves will get this blotchy, kind of lighter and darker green color, almost yellow in some areas on the leaves. That's nothing to really worry about. It's a part of the genetics of the plant, and you're going to see that on occasion. So don't worry about that. But with the sooty mold, try to get the aphids and the scale under control. I suspect you've got those there somewhere. If you can get that under control, then you might have better success with that particular variety.
All right. Dean, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Just wanted to remind you, we're partnering with UW-Madison's Extension Horticulture Program to learn more about your experiences listening to Garden Talk. We'd love to find out what you learned during the show and how you'll put it to good use, as well as your ideas for future Garden Talk topics. It's easy to fill this out, this little survey, and you can find it at wpr.org/Larry. And then just go and click on today's show note for a link, WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show note. You'll get a link to the survey. And again, the survey just asked a few questions about what you learned. And also, if you have some ideas for future topics, we're always in the market for new ideas or maybe old ideas we haven't talked about in a long time. And so certainly let us know. Another way you can do it, you can type in go.wisc.edu/radio. That's go.wisc.edu/radio. Do that in any browser. It'll just take you, 2-3 minutes at the most probably to fill it out, and we'd love to have you do that. Brian Huddleston, our guest today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Huddleston. Back with us once again, he directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Gardening questions for him, as particularly as they relate to disease, but we may be able to answer some others as well. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Maxine in Marinette, Michigan, your turn. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm from Marinette, Wisconsin. Thank you. I have a blue spruce, maybe about 6-8 years old, and it's doing really well. I've noticed it getting some brown and losing some needles. Wondered if because of such a dry weather we're having, is it a good idea to water before winter sets in?
Mm-hmm. Is your soil frozen at this point, or have you had any significant snow?
No, we're not frozen yet.
Okay, then I would continue to water about an inch of water per week. Get a soaker hose, drip hose, and if you're limited where you can water, I would water around the drip line, so that's the edge of where the branches extend, and watch how much rain you're getting. You need about an inch of water total per week, and you can continue watering that tree all the way up to the point where the ground freezes, or if you get a really heavy snowfall, and you could stop then as well. But yeah, you really, with evergreens in general, you need to be watering them into the fall so that they've got enough water stored internally to make it through the winter.
Especially evergreens.
Yes, especially evergreens. With deciduous trees, once they've dropped their leaves, you don't need to water them anymore. But evergreens definitely will need that extra water.
Yeah. Maxine, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Margaret in Milwaukee. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. I've been growing different types of beans my whole life. Never saw this problem before, but on a new variety of fava bean this year. I'm in Milwaukee. It was pretty dry. I only water at the soil level on the bean plants, and then as the fruits formed on the fruits, a white fuzzy mold.
Yeah, did it kill the plants?
I didn't know exactly what it was. It was not looking good. I took them out as that appeared. I didn't want it to spread to the others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering. There are a couple of things that will cause white fuzzy. Powdery mildews are one, but I don't see a lot of powdery mildews typically on bean plants. The reason I ask whether the plants died is the other option is a disease called white mold. It's a fungal disease. It's very aggressive and will kill the plants. And it's a broad spectrum pathogen, so it not only will take out bean plants, which is a great host for the fungus, but it will take out other types of vegetables as well. Usually you'd have to have that introduced somehow. It could be through spores that blow in. Sometimes if this, you can get contaminated seed, but what you would see in the seed would be something that looks like a little mouse or rat dropping. The fungus actually, as it ages, produces a structure called the sclerotium. It's a little mass of fungal threads that have a kind of a dark black outer rind, and it's a survival structure of the fungus. And you can sometimes get that in with seed if the seed is produced in a plot where white mold is active. So those are the possibilities. If you took out those plants early, that is great because you want to remove those plants before it has a chance to produce those dropping-like resting structures. So when you plant in that area again, I would be very careful to monitor next year to see whether you see a recurrence, because sometimes those little sclerotia, those resting structures, can get into the soil. And they'll last for many years and continue to produce spores that can reinfect your plants. So if you see it again, pull out those plants and get rid of them.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. As we've been talking the last over an hour now, I keep hearkening back to Merlin Sheldrake's best-selling book on fungi. It's called Entangled Life: How Fungi Make Our World, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. It's a wonderful book if you haven't read it yet. But he was talking about spores at one point, and he says fungi produce in the world 50 megatons of spores, which would be the equivalent to the weight of 500,000 blue whales, which is the biggest mammal on Earth.
Yeah, there are lots of fungi out there. I've seen estimates of somewhere in the order of like 15 to 18 million different fungi, and they produce a lot of spores.
A lot of spores. Oh, boy. Jim in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. We have an ash tree that right where the trunk forks, there's a kind of a wound where the bark is off, but also it's kind of down to the wood. And the question is how or whether we should seal that so that it doesn't get worse or get an infection or something.
Yeah.
We're concerned it's right where the tree forks, and another tree we had got something like this, and it led to the two. It got worse, and the two branches split apart.
Yeah,
this would be a situation where I would really recommend having a certified arborist come out and evaluate the tree. The fact that you've lost bark indicates that there's something relatively serious going on. Usually that doesn't happen unless there's some sort of either physical damage to the tree, and that can be followed by colonization by wood rot fungi, and that can cause additional decline. And if you have a certified arborist come out, they can evaluate the tree and see what's going on. If the bark is already gone, there's not much you can do about that. Unfortunately, that damage is permanent. And you might, if you're really, really lucky, the tree might eventually produce new tissue that will cover over that wound and produce new bark. But unfortunately, that's typically not what happens. Usually there's some sort of colonization by, again, these wood rot fungi that will cause additional damage and eventually lead to the death of the tree. And the fact that it's occurring at the crotch means that, again, that's weakening that area, and you could end up with that tree splitting again. You need to have a certified arborist take a look at that and see whether the tree needs to be removed. Unfortunately, yeah. I don't have any quick and easy fixes for you on that one. I'm sorry.
Good luck, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. Marlene in Nakusa, we go to you. Hi, Marlene.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have four blue spruce evergreens. They're about 10 years old. They're in a row, not real close together, but four of them in a cluster. Two of the trees have lost all their needles on the lower half of one of them. The other two are just fine. Now, my neighbor suggested that deer were eating them. Is that possible?
I'm more inclined to think it's this needle disease that I talked about. Is it the more the center two trees that are showing the symptoms by any chance?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah, there's probably...
They're 1, 2, 3, 4, and 1 and 2 are look awful. 3 and 4 are okay. Look fine.
Okay. Okay. And are those closer to a building or other trees, or I'm just wondering what the environment is like?
They're kind of spread between oak trees.
Yeah. It could very well be that it's this rhizocera needle cast disease that I talked about. It's very common on Colorado blue spruce. And if the trees are in an area that traps a little bit more moist air, then you're more likely going to see problems, this particular disease. And it tends to start towards the bottom of the tree, starts with needle loss on the interior of the branches towards the trunk, and works its way outward towards the tips and then up into the tree. And the other two trees that you have that are looking nice right now may eventually start to show problems with this disease as well. I usually start to see really serious problems on Colorado blue spruce when they get to be about 15 years old, 15 to 20. And you said yours were about 10. So you could start to see problems on your other spruces as well. There's not a lot you can do about this particular disease. The fungus that causes it is everywhere in the environment. So my only recommendation at this point is on those branches that have lost the needles, just prune those up and off of the trees that are affected. That's about the only thing you can do at this point.
Thank you, Marlene, for calling. Just sort of related to that, David emailed to ask if you can recommend a treatment for spruce trees that are experiencing needle drop that's safe for honeybees. Yeah. They're beekeepers with 12 hives about 200 feet from the spruce.
Yeah, there are fungicides that you can use, but quite frankly, with larger trees, I don't recommend them on a routine basis. It has to be a really special tree to use fungicide treatments, quite frankly, with this particular disease, because the fungicide treatments require treatment every year, starting at bud break and pretty much treating every week to 2 weeks throughout the growing season if we have a wet year. So it's a lot of time and effort to try to keep a tree looking really pretty. And quite frankly, I don't think it's worth the effort or the time or quite frankly, the money. And again, if you've got bees nearby, you do have to worry about, you know, toxic effects of some of the fungicides that you would use to do this. So for this particular disease, I would say, again, just prune up those branches. Don't try any fungicide treatments and then really think hard about what sort of trees you'd like to plant as replacements long term. And again, if anyone's interested, I have a list of trees, evergreens, that was put together by Laura Joel, who's our woody ornamental specialist here at the UW. She and I gave a couple of talks together. I talked about conifer diseases, and then she talked about good conifers to plant. And I have that list. So if you go to my website and look up my email, you're welcome to email me, and I can send you a copy of that list.
And the website is pddc.wisc.edu.
Or that's correct.
You could type in Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic UW, and it'll get there, too.
It'll pop me up.
Bill in Oregon emailed. He's seen some recent papers trying to explain the existence of white oak savanna in central and northern Wisconsin as a byproduct of endemic oak wilt that killed off most of the white oaks and virtually all the red oaks. Have you seen or heard any research pursuing the origins of oak wilt in Wisconsin?
It's probably, from what I recall, it's been a while since I read up on this, so I'm dredging my memory for what I read about this. Probably not originally native to Wisconsin, the fungus. It probably came in from elsewhere, and it's easily moved around by insects, though, so that's how it typically is introduced into an area. So it can have a huge impact in a localized setting. Once it gets in, and it's usually in Wisconsin, it's usually brought in by sap beetles that are attracted to the trees that have been wounded, and then drops off the fungus in the wounded areas as they feed, and then the tree becomes infected. But once it gets into a tree, if there are lots of oaks in the vicinity, all of those trees tend to be root grafted, particularly all of the white oaks, any of the oaks with the rounded lobes, they tend to all be root grafted. All of the oaks that are in the red oak group, which are the pointed lobe oaks, they all tend to be root grafted. Sometimes you can get grafting between white and red oaks. That's a little more uncommon, but it does occur. But once the fungus gets into one tree, it moves down the trunk through the root grafts into adjacent trees, and that can cause death of a very large number of oaks that are close to one another. And that can lead to areas where, you know, oaks are, you basically don't have any oaks at all. That's why we really recommend monitoring carefully for oak wilt, getting testing early to try to determine if you're really dealing with oak wilt, and then be very aggressive in terms of management, which involves removing the infected trees and oftentimes adjacent healthy looking trees that are probably already infected by root graft. But in terms of that leading to kind of savannas, I don't know. I've not read that particular work, so I don't know. Can't really comment on that, but it's an interesting theory.
Dan emailed, this is their first year in their house, and they have what they think is a sugar maple in the yard. It has multiple trunks, about 4 to 6 inches in diameter, and yellow fall leaves. It's had black spots on the leaves most of the year, and a large white fungus-looking strip on one of its trunks. He was planning to go over all leaves in the yard with his lawnmower, but the leaves are making him reconsider because of the spots. What should he do with all this black spotted leaves to protect the yard?
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's a silver maple, given the multi-stemmed form of the tree that's more typical of silver maples. The leaf spots are probably something called tar spot, and that's a fungal disease. And on, if it's silver maple, what you're going to see are very distinctive raised kind of mounded black tarry spots on the leaves, sometimes with a yellow halo. If you look in the center of those black spots, it'll look like somebody left a thumbprint, a fingerprint in that area. And those are reproductive structures of the fungus that causes the disease. If you're going to be mulching the leaves, that's not the best thing to do for management of that disease, because the fungus is still going to survive in that mulched up material. And then it will release spores in the springtime that can reinfect the tree. The good thing about tar spot is that it's pretty much a cosmetic disease. It doesn't cause a lot of significant damage to the trees. And you're likely going to see some of that anytime you have a maple, quite frankly. And we see this every year at some level, more of the disease when it's wetter, less of the disease when it's drier. In terms of the white on the trunk, that's more problematic. I don't know exactly which fungus that might be, but it's most likely some sort of wood rot fungus, which means that it is decaying the wood underneath the bark, and that can structurally weaken the tree. And then you have to worry about that trunk potentially being weaker to the point, if you have a high wind or some storms that come through, that can potentially break off and then fall on something and cause damage. So this would be another situation where I'd be inclined to have a certified arborist come out, one that's trained in doing hazard assessments, and have them take a look at the tree and see whether or not that particular trunk needs to be removed, or it might be a larger portion of the tree. It could be the entire tree. I've seen a lot of silver maples where you cut them down and the entire interior of the tree is rotted out from one of these wood rotters. So that's pretty common in that species.
Ella in Stillwater emailed that she has a very large green ash tree that has initially been treated for emerald ash borer in August via basal injection methods. The arborist deemed it healthy and a good candidate for treatment as the disease progresses into her region. In late September, she noticed a large orange shelf fungus growing very near the injection site. Is it a sign that the tree is already too far gone to continue treating? Should the shelf fungus now be composing, be removed?
Well, the shelf fungus is an indication. If that's on the trunk, that's an indication that the trunk is infected. And the fungus is in there probably, again, doing some rotting of the wood. I'd have to see a photo probably of that conch in order to figure out exactly what kind of fungus it is, what kind of wood rotter it is. But typically when I see fungal conks on trunks, I get worried because that means, again, the wood inside that tree is probably structurally compromised. And again, the tree is a higher risk for potentially breaking off or blowing over and causing some damage. So again, you might want to have the arborist come back and take a look at that and make sure you're using a certified arborist. That's what we recommend through UW Extension. And they are, you know, trained and certified. And definitely for something like this, you want one that has special training on hazard assessment.
Tim in New Berlin wonders, he has an Austrian pine and half the needles are brown. Should he try to save it?
Depends on how attached you are to the tree. My immediate thought is probably has a lot of diplodia tip light or shoot light, and that's a real serious problem. You have to prune that out, and you have to make an assessment after you've pruned out all of that dead material. How aesthetically pleasing is that tree in your landscape? And the thing of it is even if you prune out all of that dead material, the rest of the tree, it sounds like it's a really susceptible individual Austrian pine. So a lot of the other what are currently healthy branch tips could become infected as well. And really the only way to prevent that is routine fungicide treatments, which tend to get relatively expensive. Again, you'd have to have a professional come in and do that for you. So my recommendation would be to consider replacing that tree with something else.
Phoebe emailed, they have several 20-year-old, 40-foot-tall Colorado blue spruces that are declining due to needle cast. They're thinking about starting several 5-foot emerald arborvitae and Norway spruce under the declining spruces at the drip line to catch the southern sun. Once the arborvitae or Norway have grown about 10 feet, they would cut down what's left of the blue spruces. Anything they could do to soil underneath the trees to help them?
I would clean up as many of those needles as possible. The arborvitaes aren't going to be susceptible to the needle cast. The Norway spruce, I occasionally see the needle cast on that particular kind of spruce, but it's not a serious problem typically. Good spacing, though, you need to make sure that all of those shrubs that you're putting in, the trees you're putting in, are spaced far enough apart to take into account how big they're going to get when they grow to full size. You don't want overlap in those trees. That tends to trap the moist air that can lead to other types of diseases. But I think the strategy is pretty sound to get those established, to get them up a little ways, and then remove the Colorado blue spruces. But those are pretty good trees and shrubs to plant. Just make sure when you put them in, you give them sufficient water, particularly the arborvitaes. I've seen a lot of situations where new transplants are not watered enough and they brown out.
And water right up to freeze.
Up to freeze, yeah, with evergreens, yep.
On that note, boy, this was a great show. Thank you so much, Brian, for this. I think a lot of people learned a lot. And I hope.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I hope you go to our show today, WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's show note. And fill out that little short questionnaire, which will take you just about 2 minutes to do. I would love to have you do that for us. Well, Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Monday, our physical therapist back to talk about lower back pain and managing it. And Lisa Johnson joins us next week for Garden Talk. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.